The following contains strong language, violence, and nudity. It is intended only for mature audiences. Discretion advised.
Welcome to Spawnometer number 31, covering a story by Todd McFarlane and Greg Capullo. No special thanks this time, it's all our regular guys. The story is called Homecoming. It's dedicated to Tom Palmer. Do you know who that is?
Tom Palmer. Hold on, Tom Palmer. Addicted to Love?
Robert Palmer.
Oh, my bad.
Tom Palmer, he was one of the more famous Marvel inkers of the Bronze Age. In particular, he did a lot of inking over John Buscema and Gene Colan. Definitely one of the best inkers Marvel had. Stepped up the game of pretty much every penciler he worked with. By the 90s, he was getting a little older and his stuff was kind of rough. They had him inking Mike Deodato and he did his run on Avengers. And to some degree, I felt like he marred it. But on the other hand, there were so many people claiming to be Mike Deodato, they were coming out of Glasshouse Studios, it probably weren't, because he had done the whole Neil Adams thing where he trained a bunch of guys to draw like him, that it might have been that they were only getting like loose pencils for the Avengers and Tom Palmer was us to finish him. I did feel like we got a little bit robbed of that prime Mike Deodato experience on Avengers because of the Tom Palmer inks, but still it doesn't minimize what an incredible inker he was, particularly his work over Buscema in the 80s when they were using a lot of Zip-a-tones and stuff. Really awesome. And his son went on to write for Wizard Magazine. He had an article where he covered like independent comics and stuff. I don't know what particular influence Tom Palmer had over Todd McFarlane's life. It might have been a simple matter of him being one of the artists who didn't go to Image that at least gave well wishes and wasn't all spiteful and shit, but that's who he was dedicated to. Okay. And then the cover was the image of Anti-Spawn's face in close-up, reflecting in his metal portions of his mask, Spawn cowering, and there's all this necroplasm splashing around. What'd you think of the cover?
Oh, great, dude. I like the Redeemer.
Yeah. Yeah, and I guess they call him Anti-Spawn throughout the previous stories, and this is where he actually...
When he was Jason, they called him Anti-Spawn. Now they're calling him Redeemer.
Right. The angels, when they're making him, mention that he's their Redeemer, and then later on in the issue, he insists on being referred to as Redeemer. So I like the whole Anti-Spawn thing, but you wouldn't want to do that permanently. He needs to have his own name.
Yeah, no. I would say your name gives you purpose.
Nominative determinism. So, right, basically meaning
down.
That your
calm
name...
Calm down, Mr. Peabody. Calm down.
Right. Your name helps to guide the person you're going to become. There's this argument whatever you get named is going to help to shape who you are because of the perceptions of what that name means to people when they meet you, essentially.
Well, this one, they definitely hit the nose or finger on the nose where the character they picked to be the Redeemer is actually trying to redeem himself.
And we'll get into that more once we get into the story, but definitely yeah. I agree with you. I like the cover. It's pretty cool. So the issue was released on May 18th, 1995. This was the same month we saw Wonder Woman number 100. It's a shame that George Perez never made it over to Image. We had the launch of Sovereign 7 number 1, which is another instance where you got a guy who pussyfooted around with Image in the early days, but ultimately ended up doing his creator-owned series at DC Comics. You've got the Punisher line getting canceled. They have a crossover arc called Countdown that's supposed to lead to his suicide, where they ripped off Vigilante's number 50 ending. This is the month where they canceled all the Punisher titles after 9 years of him reigning in comics. And as far as Image goes, it was a notable month because you had Wildstorm Rising, one of the big crossovers, maybe the first big crossover that Wildstorm ever did. You've got the final issue of the ongoing Shadowhawk series coming out this month. And I think it's especially notable that you have the launch of Evangeline over at Maximum, because I would argue that she is, if not the, she's definitely in the top two characters that launched out of Maximum, probably helped to establish Maximum Press. We're just a few months away from Rob Liefeld leaving Image. Now that he's firming up the ground of his next home, we're seeing that the transition is going to come soon.
Okay. All right. So we got Spawn being reintroduced to New York. We see the old Twin Towers as he's showing up. His cape is still in a hibernetic state where it's not really reacting. It's stringy behind him. It doesn't have that luscious curls that is always spinning around him. He's heading back to his alley, which we see Bootsy and another guy kind of hanging out there. It's the guy that he reanimated. I can't remember his name.
He gets home on the train and there's like 50 people hobos coming off of this train.
People jump off the train. That's right.
That's a lot of damn hobos, man.
Yeah.
But there's something we haven't been...
And not one of them had a stick with a sack on it. I was really disappointed.
Right. That one's got like boils all over his face and shit though. It's like he's been through the Black Plague or some shit. But I do like that shot of the Twin Towers because even though Spawn hasn't been gone from New York for very long, you definitely get that sense of homecoming by seeing that night sky and everything.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. The Twin Towers back in the day definitely told you you were in New York.
And I also like the part where he's running across the rooftops because it's a nice, beefy Capullo Spawn from his earlier style before he gets assimilated by that McFarlane style and makes him all lanky and shit. So I like seeing that version of Spawn again.
He runs into Bootsy and Billy, and Bootsy's depressed because he put his boots up on Spawn's throne as almost like they did a memorial for him because they hadn't seen him in a long time. And he's telling Billy how he misses Boots. And then Spawn, very out of character, jumps out and says boo.
Yeah, well, there's a lot of him being out of character here too, because he's really palling around with these guys as well.
Yeah, which was really weird because I'm so used to like
get
emo.
The fuck away from emo me. Spawn. I'm sorry.
You know, the Smiths are playing in the background while he's cutting himself because he's sad. And he's
what's
like,
the black
boo. And he's hugging him. Like, come here, buddies. I'm like, I remember reading it. I was like, was this a fill-in writer? Like, that maybe didn't read a lot of Spawn and just, it just felt really weird. So,
did I like them showing him actually having a relationship with these guys? Because it never makes sense to me because of how fucked up and abusive the relationship is, why these guys would give a shit about him.
Yeah.
And I also really love that Billy's got that like rosacea on his head to show where the bullets had gone through. And he, I think it was especially necessary in this episode since it's going to play into it. But I really like that, and it makes him much more distinctive.
So we're introduced to the new guardian of Earth from heaven, Raphael. I mean,
yeah, you can see
she looks like your snobby New York type.
She looks like a skank. You know, let's be honest, she's dressing like a 20-something hooker, but the lines say more like pushing 60. And she's got that weird hair that like goes into a swirl, like an upward swirl. I don't know where they were going with this.
In the Golden Girls, which one is she? I'm thinking
she's Rue McClanahan, definitely.
Who?
She's got to be Rue McClanahan. She's got to be Blanche because that leopard print is ready to rock.
Yeah, okay. So on a Golden Girl scale, she's a 4. And so at the time, she's communicating with the angels that are up in their, I guess their space station, which I always thought it was kind of cool that like they have a space station above the Earth. Well, and they have the suit that I guess they removed from Jason. We'll still call it the anti-Spawn suit.
Mm-hmm.
And it's kind of jumping around and it's in this nuclear heavenly
like a furnace
judgment fire going on, and it's kind of hopping around.
One thing that's interesting about these guys too is that going back to the timeline, Angela shows us all the heavenly warriors and they're all like these super babes and stuff. Yeah. And it very much gives you the impression that that's what all the angels are like. But I think between his one-off issue of Spawn and the miniseries, you had the Grant Morrison run, and he's the one who introduced these masculine, semi-masculine, they're somewhat androgynous, angels that are golden with the cracked skulls and the fire coming out, kind of like Firestorm or something.
These are the guys, right?
I guess these are the guys, yeah. And these are the like the Science Brigade simpy. Or something.
They look a little simpy.
But it's interesting because in my mind, I think that this is somewhat true for you as well, is you always tend to think of Elysium and you tend to think about all the female warrior angels, and that's like heaven to you. But I guess that's sort of a different part of the heavens, and there's more branches and more of a diversity of types.
Well, you got to figure it's just like hell, the different levels, you have the different demons, so you're gonna have different angels.
And I'm wondering too, it's too soon after the miniseries for McFarlane and Gaiman to be having troubles, but I'm wondering if we're not getting all these elderly looking angels to differentiate, but from these angels that McFarlane has complete creative control over versus the babe angels of Neil Gaiman. So I'm wondering if that's why we were suddenly getting all these elderly angels. I'm here for it because I think it's really interesting, because there's definitely never been a heaven that we've seen quite like this.
Okay.
And I also think that the new lady that takes over for Gabrielle, since she got busted for trying to conspire against Angela, mm-hmm. she reminds me in terms of her attitude a little bit of the one from Beetlejuice that is trying to help the couple negotiate the afterlife and shit.
Are you Juno, our caseworker?
Yes, I evaluate individual cases and determine if help is needed, deserved, and available.
Are you available?
No.
Yeah, yeah, the one that's smoking and has her slit throat and the smoke comes out. I would see her playing her in a live-action movie.
Mm-hmm.
She's not a Golden Girl 4, though. She's not, that's more like a Golden Girl 2, but okay.
Well, she's got a little bit of a Sophia thing going on, too.
Ugh. Anyway, so this was the boring part to me, because we get back to Terry whining and crying, trying to hack, I think. What was he
trying to do? He's not really whining and crying, though. You look at him, he's got that look of determination, and he's not all beat up anymore. I like the way Greg Capullo is drawing him. He's not broken anymore. He's pissed. And we've seen him broken for a few months now, so we're seeing seeing him kind of come back from that, it looks like to me.
But he's trying to get into a system where he keeps getting denied. I guess he's running out of avenues at work for protection.
Yeah, they've set aside all the relevant information on Wynn and the conspiracy within the agency, and he's still set on investigating it because even though he's in the clear now, you know, nobody's after him anymore, and in fact, they're offering him all these jobs and shit, he's not going to rest until he finds out who fucked him over and gets him back, and also brings him to justice, because that was the whole point in the first place, is he's trying to find out where these rotten apples are in the agency and root them out.
Yeah. So then Spawn is sitting on his throne talking to Billy and Bootsy, and he's kind of rehashing, you know, the Angela affair. Maybe he was a little too hard with those two kids, even dealing with the Klan. Bootsy's like, you know, what's going on with your cape here? You know, it's not luscious and curly. And Spawn's kind of like, you know, ever since I've gotten back from... So are we calling it anything or are we calling it heaven?
Heaven, you call it what makes work, okay. What works for you.
So every time I think about it, I'm thinking of that Guns N' Roses knock, knock, knocking on heaven's door. And then we are introduced to Phil Temper, who looked like the Doll Man to me from the DC comics.
Yeah, he's super fucking goober.
Creepy, dude.
With his fucking freckles and shit. Yeah, well, he definitely looks like he keeps people's severed heads in jars and shit.
Oh, yeah. Oh, absolutely,
just
man.
Way
absolutely.
Too clean cut, and because they're talking about how he's like
he doing has a
like,
suit made out of human skin.
Yeah, because they're talking about how he's committing like Grand Theft Auto and shit. It's like, not Phil Temper, this dude's a fucking psycho.
Yeah,
but this they the sell him as being a saint. Basically, he when he went to jail, he turned his life around, embraced God. Now he works in super kitchen.
I wonder how that happened. A few too many soap drops. Never know, man. So anyway, he's blasted by some kind of energy force and sent up to the satellite. And that's where he's getting baked with nuclear fire diffusion. That's actually a pretty intense look where I'm assuming Jason was just encased in the suit and this guy, they're cooking him into the suit.
Yeah. What they were talking about, how they put the fire into Jason and he wasn't a willing vessel and he was a compromised vessel. And so it just wasn't taking. And that's why he was in this agony, because he was an evil person who couldn't handle. Whereas Phil here has apparently legitimately given himself over to Christ, a completely willing vessel. His body will accept the fire. He will accept the will of the people who are running Orbital Station 1 here, these angelic beings. And so they've got a good match this time. But unfortunately, part of what he's going to have to endure is his barely concealed. I like how they use one of his arms to conceal his butt crack, but otherwise the dude's full on nude. They're going to apparently blow him to pieces and then reincorporate him as a completely pure version of the anti-Spawn.
So yeah, that was pretty intense. I mean, You see the fear, you know, you see his eyes. And of course we do the nude broadcast, CNN, E and KRFDE, where they kind of all talking about this.
They really didn't need this page this time. All they're doing is talking more and more about how this guy was sainted figure. Yeah, talking about how
Phil disappeared. That's it. I read the first one, they read the second. I'm like, are you fucking making me read the same shit over and over? Like, really, Todd? Are you just trying to fill a page here, Todd?
The dude's a saint. We get it. Can we move on, my man?
Then we go to Sam and Twitch. Apparently Sam is glad of his gluttonous because his scale, and he's fucking with the chief, leaving him little notes, and I guess pushing the chief to the breaking point. Bond is sitting in the alleyway, he's hanging out with his bros. He's now taking on the role of protector, which is a little weird. And again, you're right, he's drawn really cool looking. I dig the way it looks. It almost looks like the chains are holding him up like Doc Ock, because they're kind of around him and they're pushing around, and the suit immediately reacts to something, and it or the chains do, and they kind of drag him, and it's doing that whole Doc Ock thing where he's like leaping around.
It reminds me a little bit of God's Path from Donnie Darko, where all the sword and the chains are just going off around corners and leading him to where he needs to be.
True, yeah. And it's taking him to where the Redeemer is melting Billy?
He's doing some weird shit with him because he's got all this golden goo over him. I guess that's the holy version of necroplasm. And he just jizzed all over him.
Yeah, and they're teleporting him. And so Spawn confronts the Redeemer.
How do you like those speech bubbles?
What do you mean?
How the word balloons have the cross embedded in.
Oh, yeah, I thought that was kind of neat. Yeah, I thought that was a nice touch.
So you know that he's speaking from the higher power, I guess.
Well, it would have been nice if he spoke more like Shakespearean.
This is Tom Orzechowski, you know, if we'd had Todd Klein, he'd have done something really cool with the, like, he'd probably had script or something in there.
Yeah, something like that's kind of what I expected the Redeemer would be like, just talking in scripture all the time and shit, like the Lamb has come, shit like that. So he's teleporting Billy, smacks the shit out of Spawn, and again Spawn is in a very weak state. So
Redeemer anti-Spawn previously owned the shit out of Spawn anyway, so it's a good thing that he's not here for for Spawn because, you know, there's a good chance this guy would have kicked his ass anyway. But the only thing that's really saving him is that he's not the target.
The Redeemer blasts Spawn in the chest and he drops dead. And they run up to check on him, all the guys. He's like, don't worry, guys. I already had a hole in me from the last time. You know, the suit just kind of grew over the hole. So I don't know. That's weird. Like, he just left the hole in his giant, you know, giant hole in his chest. Not to breathe or eat or anything. Just a big hole.
Well, I mean, it's not like he does, though. I mean, the only thing we've ever seen him do is like drink.
But does he really taste it? Hell, where does it go?
Yeah,
that's the weird thing. So anyway, the suit then reacts and starts trying to protect Spawn, and it starts attacking the homeless guys, and he tells everyone to run. The suit kind of does this weird like Carnage thing where it, like, stretch out. Then we get the clock again at 6971. The suit then starts to kind of like wiggle, and I have this sense of the morphing guy from Slither, you know, it's encased them, or I don't know, he just starts to mutate, and this is where Spawn evolves to the next Spawn.
Yeah, my best guess is that he finally worked all that venom out of his system, and that the suit is leveling up. It had been traumatized. It had been in shock. They kept talking about how it wasn't working properly because of the experiences it had in Elysium. And that, I guess, maybe being exposed to these holy powers again kickstarted him or reset him, or was like a fibrillator where it's got its rhythm back and then some, because he forms a new costume around Spawn.
Yeah.
The costume lives again. Next issue, a new look, which I thought was an interesting choice of words, because you remember Batman in the old days, he added the oval to his chest, a yellow oval.
Oh, yeah.
And that's from that point onward, he was referred to as New Look Batman. That was the version that Carmen Infantino did. And that was the first time the DC consciously moved away from the Bob Kane style. For the previous couple of decades, they made a point of trying to emulate Bob Kane that entire time. And that was the point where they finally decided, look, we're in the mid-60s now. It's time for Batman to make a change. So we're going to change his costume up some, and we're going to have him look like, you know, this new art style. And so I thought that was an interesting choice of words, because I'm wondering if Todd was coming at it from a similar place, like, this is our new look Spawn now.
Well, yeah, because he does that weird, you know, one gauntlet's bigger than the other.
Yeah. It's all in silhouette now, but you can tell that it's a lot different.
I don't know. I have my Spawn figure somewhere around here. I guess it's in the other room. I was going to use them. I usually keep them in my computer room.
Well, since we haven't seen the costume in this issue, I think probably we'll cover that one next time.
Okay. So what'd you think?
I'm a little disturbed because we've read...
I knew that about you since day one, but... Tell me about the comic.
We've read multiple issues of Spawn in a row, and each one has actually been, can I say, good? Are we allowed to have good Spawn comics that we are entertained by and enjoy?
Good. I think you're pushing the word good there.
Really? I thought the stories have been pretty damn good.
I thought they were fine. I didn't at any time start wondering about, you know, anything else in the world going on. I kind of stuck with them.
The story's progressing. We've had multiple stories where they were done in ones. This is the first time in a few months where we've had a multi-parter, but it sets up at the end of the issue. I want to see what's going to happen in the next issue. I'm legitimately curious. I think maybe Todd's getting better. I'm not saying that it's fucking Alan Moore over here and shit, but I think it's comparable with any other comic book that come out that month story-wise.
Did you just compliment Alan Moore?
Relative to Todd McFarlane.
Okay, because I was about to say.
Yeah, but I mean, what I'm saying is that for the longest time, Spawn has been a book that's gotten by on its production values and its artwork, and I feel like these last few issues, we're reading a comic book that is comparable with other comic books, that doesn't have to be graded on a curve, on a par with the average comic of any other publisher.
Okay, I can work with that.
Well, given that this was like the number one comic book in the nation for many years, it's nice that it's finally has the entertainment value of it.
But let's be honest, was it number one because of its writing, or was it number one because of a lot of speculation?
It's number one for a whole slew of factors, including the artwork especially, and the toys and everything else.
Well, yeah, I would say the artwork. Definitely the artwork.
Yeah.
I personally know people who bought it just for the artwork.
I'm no stranger to watching mediocre books be at the top of the reading lists. It's nice for me to see Spawn, because the rest of the package was already there. It's nice for me to see Spawn finally have writing that validates its position in the sales ranks. Not that it's, again, the greatest writing of all time, but it's at least good enough to where I don't feel like, you know, you have to, well, it's that way because X, Y, and Z. It's like, no, it's actually, the package is now there to where I can believe that this would be a number one book in the country.
Okay. You've made your point, sir. I thought it was pretty good. I mean, it was okay. It was out of character for Spawn.
Yeah, but I think
but I guess I like that character growth in it, mm-hmm. if you could call it that.
My thing is, I wish that he'd done the whole hard traveling heroes thing for longer. I think he got back to New York really too quick. We only had a couple of issues.
Like a Roman samurai through the U.S.
A little Ronin action. Yeah, get him to see some different places and some different environments. It's kind of cool to see him in a bog and shit like that. And just get him out of New York. New York is such a heavily covered place in comic books especially. But also, you've seen just in the weeks that he was missing and working his way back slowly to New York, he's happy to be home. He's happy to be among the people that actually want to spend time with him. He's glad that he's not being constantly confronted by these moral dilemmas. He could just beat the fuck up out of, you know, random assholes that run into his alleys and shit like he's used to. So it's nice to have seen him take that journey, but I do wish he'd been gone a little bit longer, just so that when you do get impact from him finally being back in New York, but it's only been a couple of issues. I think it would have been even more impactful if it had run like a 6-issue arc and then he's back in New York. But I still enjoy it for what's on the page.
Okay.
Wizard Series 3, card number 1. This is the Chromium Series, Violator, created by Todd McFarlane. Real name, Violator. Age, centuries old. Height, 3'4" in human form, which means he's shorter than Danny DeVito. Height, 11'2.5" in demon form. Weight, 203 pounds in human form, 725 pounds in demon form. First appearance, Spawn number 2. Origin. Though next to nothing is known about the creature that calls itself the Violator, what is known is that he is one of the 5 demonic creatures who call themselves the Flebiac Brothers. All of the brothers, Violator, Vacillator, Vindicator, Vaporizer, and Vandalizer, are denizens of the 8th Sphere of Hell, and serve the demon lord who granted powers to the hero known as Spawn. Powers. Though the full extent of the Violator's powers are unknown, he has exhibited shape-shifting abilities, superhuman strength, and incredible stamina, and he has proven to be nearly indestructible.
No more clowning around! I'm not the Vindicator, or the Victimizer, or the Vaporizer, or the Violator. I'm the Violator!
Which leads us directly into the much less well-known follow-up series, Violator vs. Bad Rock, by Alan Moore, Brian Denham, and Jonathan Sabal. Were you at all familiar with Brian Denham?
No.
When I was a little kid, I mean, it starts when I was like 5 years old, my brothers had, I went into one of their rooms and they had a drawer full of comic books. I'd open it, I'd never opened this thing before. I was like, oh my gosh, like, what are these, you know? And this was like 1974 or 5, you know? But I was just blown away by all these comic books. And one of my brothers, he said, he's like, oh, they're comic books and people draw them and write them and color them. And, you know, and then they color them with little dots. You know, he thought all the half-tone dots were like they were like hand done. And I was like, well, I'm going to do that when I grow up. And right then I just, that was it. I was committed. I just kept focusing on making comics. And even... I didn't ever want to get kicked out of comics, so I learned how to, like, do every step of them, you know, letter and write and color and everything. So I was like, there's nobody going to tell me I can't make comic books. I'm from Dallas mostly, and I used to go around the Dallas Fantasy Fair, which is a big convention back in the day, and in the 80s and 90s. And I'd show my artwork to different editors and stuff, and they'd give me tips. And Cary Gamble, this big-time Marvel guy, he was from Dallas. And I would show him at conventions every 6 months or so. Every time they had a convention, he would always show up, and I'd bring my portfolio and show him. And John Cassaday from the X-Men, that's how he got broke into, was like, you know, Cary was teaching him some stuff, you know. But so this went on for a few years, like from when I was, oh my gosh, like 14 to, you know, 18. And I had some interest from a couple of Marvel editors. And they even would hand out their numbers, and I could call them in New York talk to him there on the phone, but I wasn't getting any traction, and I was like 18, and I was like, oh, I can't wait any longer, you know. I thought this was going to happen immediately,
right?
So I joined the Marines. I was like, I'm done, and you know, I got to develop my skills, you know. And so I kept focusing on that while I was in the Marines. When I got out of the Marines, me and a buddy that I joined with, he had some money from his mom dying, or his grandma dying, and we published a self-published comic book. And from there, I worked a couple of years at a comic book store and kept trying, and to make my own comic book that I published in '94 called My Name Is Mud. And I worked at a comic book store in Fort Worth called Heroes. And we were part of the Jim Lee Killer Instinct tour, you know, with Mark Silvestri. It was a big thing back in '94. I mean, it was huge. And Jim Lee's bus came through, and Mark Silvestri went to a different city. But we had Jim Lee, and I worked the store all day long. And at the end of the day, the manager of the store let me meet Jim Lee. And so I showed him my portfolio and, you know, my pages I was working on for this My Name is Mud comic book. And he's, you know, gave me some really great criticism, you know. But he's like, you are right there, you know. He's like, about 6 more months of practice, you could break in. I was like, that's the best thing I've heard, you know.
Right.
And I was like, all right, I'm going to do it, you know. And he gave me tons of stuff to focus on, too. So, I, you know, 6 more months, I published that My Name is Mud. Self-published it, got it through Diamond and stuff. And then I met Dan Frega at the Dallas Fantasy Fair in 94. And he liked my stuff, and we talked. And he's like, let me introduce you to Rob, you know. Rob Liefeld was there. I was like, what? No way. And so he walked me over to Rob's table, and Rob had just gotten done with this, like a million people in his line, you know, it was crazy. And, but he was still full of energy, and Dan Frega introduced him to me, or, you know, us together. And so I showed him the book, and he liked it, but we just talked for a few minutes, and that was it. One of the other guys, because when I would go to these conventions, like Todd Knock and Jaime Mendoza, you know, it was a big inker, and Todd's a big artist. They were at the shows too, and they were always, you know, we were always in portfolio lines together. Sometimes you would just meet up or whatever. It was like all the local guys knew each other while we were getting reviewed by editors. But Jaime had interest from Rob, and I did too. But I saw Rob again the next week at San Diego Comic Con, and Dan introduced me to him again. But he didn't need any introduction. Rob remembers everything, you know. He's like, hey, you're that My Name is Mud guy from Dallas, right? I was like, yeah. He's like, you want a job? I was like, yes. I mean, I couldn't breathe. I was like, I was trying to play it cool, you know, but there was no cool there. I was just like, yeah, I'd like a job, yeah. And he's like, all right, show up on Monday at my office in Orange County, you know, near Los Angeles, and I'll put you to work. I was like, okay, I could not breathe, man. I was just like, boof. I was like, okay. So I like walked off, and everybody was like congratulating me from Extreme Studios and all this stuff. I had like $20 in my pocket. And I was like, I got nowhere to stay, nowhere to live, nothing. And Matt Hawkins, who was you know, the president of Top Cow now, but he was Rob's like right-hand man back in the day. He was like, we're going to put you up. We're going to, you know, don't worry about nothing. We will take care of you. And so he talked it over with Todd Knock that I would stay at Todd's place. And, you know, Todd's like, you can stay with me, but you got 10 days to make enough money to get out of here and get your own place.
Right, right.
I was like, okay. And like Rob paid every Friday. So whatever you did that week, you turned in a voucher in the morning, you get paid at the end of the day, which was amazing, you know. And because it's like, what was I working at a comic book store, you know, for a few months before? And it's like, and then it's like, every day we will pay you, just, you know, Friday, just hit it. I got on one of the trains that would take you up, like Amtrak, and took me up to Orange County with Todd and stuff. And I went home with Todd. We watched MST 3K all night, and then came back the next morning, because Todd's thing was, I will get there in the morning before Rob Liefeld gets there, and I will leave after Rob Liefeld leaves, you know. And so we would show up early in the morning and stay until midnight, because Rob was like always there, you know. And but Todd was like, I will never let Rob leave before, I mean, like, you know, Todd would not leave before Rob left.
Right, right.
He was so focused on his work. And I just went, and Rob was like, just do pinups, just pinups of all my characters, you know. And the first day I did, I won a Bad Rock. He asked me to show some pictures of Bad Rock. So I did like 4 sketches, and he's like, do that one, you know. And I turned it into a double page spread, and I got it right there. Rob liked it, and had one of the guys ink it, and one of the guys color it. And 10 days later, it was published in on a Wednesday. It came out the following Wednesday at the comic book stores in Youngblood Battle Zone number 2. And that was the most impressive thing I think I've ever seen, is like how fast that turnaround time was back in the day. It's like, I drew it on a Monday, colored it on a Tuesday, you know, or inked it on Tuesday, colored it on Wednesday. sent it to the printer, printed the book, and it was on stands like so fast. It was crazy. I was like, I just drew this thing, and now it's, you know, I'm going to a comic book store and seeing it on the shelves, you know.
And he's done several pieces for me commission-wise, some of the best stuff I own. And I thought he did a pretty fucking fantastic job on this series. And it really is a shame that it isn't better known. People know Violator. People are aware of that series. They know Alan Moore wrote it. They know Bart Sears drew it. But I don't think hardly anybody even knows Violator versus Bad Rock even exists. Because this is after the bust, and it seems like maybe the people had moved on. It's like one of those lost Alan Moore stories, it seems to me.
Oh, yeah, yeah. No, you're right. I wasn't really familiar with this one.
A big thing about Todd McFarlane's section of Image is where everybody else tried to become Napoleons. They all had these mini magnates and shit with their own studios and shit. McFarlane was the one guy who's like, I'm going to keep putting out Spawn, and when I put out anything besides Spawn, it's going to be something special. He did Violator, and it was something special, and then he allowed Extreme Studios to do Violator versus Bad Rock, and I guess they just didn't have the promotion or the cachet. So the first issue of the four-issue miniseries came in as the 209th best-selling comic of 1995.
Wow.
So by comparison, the first issue of Violator versus Bad Rock sold maybe better than the last issue of Violator miniseries, and probably not even that well, because by 95 the market had dropped to such a degree that they're probably not even comparable. By the third issue, it was ranked at the 297th best-selling comic book of that year. There was a two-month delay on issue number two, but they did eventually catch it up. Just to get a sense of where we're at on the Turok-o-meter, by the time the miniseries is getting started, that book is already on issue 31 and Spawn is on issue 32. So this is probably a year or so out from the Violator miniseries. The story is called Rocks and Hard Places, and also Danny Meekie does inking on some of the later issues.
Now at this point, you said the market was falling,
By 95, the market had pretty well collapsed. The bust started in 93, and you started seeing the real heavy collapse by 94. So in 95, things were getting pretty fucking desperate, as I recall. So just a little background with Brian Denham. Before he had done this book, he did a book called My Name is Mud for Incognito Comics, almost certainly taken from the Prodigy song, Primus song.
Primus, I was about to say.
And he'd also done Bad Rock's Youngblood Battle Zone profile. So basically, they're Ohatmu or Who's Who for Extreme Studios. He'd done the pinup for Bad Rock, probably as an audition or in anticipation of this miniseries, or he was just a badass pinup, and that's how he got the book.
But if you really want a story, my first job at Extreme Studios, I can never live that down, is Alan Moore wrote my first book, you know, and people tease me all the time. They're like, your first work in comics was written by Alan Moore. You don't deserve that or whatever. You know? But when I was working at Rob, you know, he told me, oh, you suck at drawing women, and we'll only give you a book with monsters in it. And Todd McFarlane came in the studio one day, and he had miniatures of Violator and, you know, action figure prototypes of Violator and Spawn, or Violator and Bad Rock. And he was showing them to Lightbulb. And Rob came running back in the bullpen, and he's like, oh, Denham, I got your book right here. You know, it's Violator versus Bad Rock, you know. And he's like, it'd be perfect for it. Just be a big old monster fight. And I was like, oh, my God, that would be awesome. And he goes, who do you want to write it? And we start looking around like there were writers in the bullpen, you know. And he was thinking I was going to choose one of those guys. And I said, Alan Moore. He goes, what? He goes, there is no effing way we can get Alan Moore to write your book. I just deadpanned him. I was like, you're Rob Liefeld. You can do anything.
Right.
He's like, all right. He's like, F, you know, just because. He's like, all right. And he walked out. And a week later, they had called Alan Moore, got a hold of him, asked him if he wanted to write this book, and he said yes. And the story goes, I don't know if it's true, but he needed beer money or something. And he said he'd write it. And that was it. I was committed, you know. And Rob came back and told me, you got your book. You know, Rob, you know, Alan Moore's going to write your book. And again, you know, with Rob, I was trying to play it cool. I was like, all right. He's like, how are you not more excited? Jesus Christ, about your skin. I was just like, but man, my heart was just like a cartoon. It was like, duh, 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 duh.
And so the miniseries starts in Washington, D.C.
I can tell you right off the bat, this was one of my least favorite books that we were reading at the time.
You mean of the ones we're covering?
Yeah, the Violator stories.
Yeah, so you didn't like this one as much as the first
one? No, I blew through this one as fast as I could. I mean, the artwork was fine. The story felt really weird.
Well, what is the story, though?
So basically, the Violator's attacking a van, armored vehicle.
Which I don't entirely understand. I think that he was trying to kill some more mobsters, which is, I think, a fairly loose understanding of his whole motivation.
Yeah. And apparently they had Badrock in the vehicle.
Yeah, it was apparently a trap that they'd set specifically to
because they wanted to catch him. They knew he was from hell, or there's a science organization that knows he's from hell, and they're trying to study creatures from there. They know there's one loose. Kind of very Predator 2 feel to it.
Yeah. The specific person who enlists Badrock is a lovely Dr. Sally McAllister. She looks like a Fox News anchor. And yes, she's working with the Whiteside Parsons Institute, which I feel, because of the complicated name, was intended to have more going on, but I don't think they do anything outside of this miniseries. And so it's part of Project Dante, where they're trying to lure these celestial beings in order to go to these other dimensions, basically these heaven or hell dimensions.
Well, yeah, because they want to mine them for new minerals and new technologies, and Badrock is trying to capture the Violator. He beats the shit out of the Violator, which I thought was weird. I would have figured the Violator could take on Badrock.
Well, it is worth noting that the people from the Institute fire some sort of specialized weapons at...
Oh, that's right. That's right. Like, yeah. Trank weapons.
Yeah, so they've got something to because it seems to me like it's a pretty decent fight between Violator and Badrock at first, until the Tranks come in, and that's when they take Violator down.
It is pretty cool the way they're flying him into the lab where he's hooked on between two helicopters.
Yeah, it looks like it takes that much just to lift the guy up. I wonder how much that dude's supposed to weigh.
Yeah, you would think he wouldn't weigh so much, as skinny as he was.
Yeah, right?
And so they start talking about how they saw the Violator in the mall, they saw the portal.
And we see the inside of the Whiteside Parsons Institute, and it's interesting because it's one of those buildings where the center is sort of hollow, and it's just like level upon level circling around that building. I actually worked at a building in Midtown that was similar to this, and I've once stayed in a prison that was converted into a hotel that also had a similar design to this.
The life you live, Frank. The life you live. At which point we are introduced back to the Violator. He's behind some kind of energy bars, which are keeping him trapped. They want to start dissecting him and shit like that, don't they?
They're definitely studying him. I don't know if they're going so far as to dissect him, but it's definitely not a hospitable environment.
And the whole time he's kind of fucking with Badrock, trying to get in his head, trying to get him to fight so he can break free. Badrock is able to blow it off, I guess, not without being a little pissed off.
Well, I think it's a similar dynamic as with Spawn. Badrock, let's face it, is not the genius of the Youngblood group either. And true. So he's like
13-year-old kid, right?
I think he's supposed to be 16.
Okay. He's more worried about Youngblood and what they think. And at this time, was it an angel? Who's that woman that breaks up or just breaking in? I was confused.
Because the Violator has been captured, people know that he's on Earth and they know that he's being restrained. So he knows that people are going to be coming after him. Basically, he knows that one of the angels, like Angela, is going to get a hunting license and come after him. And his big thing is he just wants to know which one it is so he knows what he's dealing with. And he wants to try to get out of this trap as soon as possible because he knows once one of those angels come, he does not want to be a sitting duck. And so when the angel does show up, basically looks like Angela, but with white hair and with purple highlights rather than the color scheme of Angela. But this person is way more brutal than Angela. Like, there's some security guards that try to stop her from getting into the building, and she just tears the shit out of them with no regard for human life. And so as the security cameras start picking her up, Violator's asking, oh, just describe her. When Badrock does, he's like, Celestine, you're in trouble. Come to think of it, so am I. So Celestine, she has a necklace of rebel angel teeth. She recommended the plagues of Egypt. She was the one who ordered the airstrike against Sodom and Gomorrah. Basically, she's the John Bolton of heaven.
Without the scruffy mustache?
Well, we don't know what she's got going on under that skirt.
Low blow. So she's powering through, getting to Violator. She's shot to the point where her clothes is ripped off her body. She reaches her staff of power, and then boom, there you go. Full on angel.
Yeah,
and
that's when she gets her
angelic power to kill everybody.
Yeah, so she's dressed like Psylocke, but more fetishistically, because she's got more buckles and stuff. She's got the black kiss makeup, just like Angela, because she's clearly supposed to be one of the same group as Angela, and she's got the long flowing white hair rather than the Strawberry Blonde like Angela's got. I do think it's worth noting too that Celestine is copyright Alan Moore. So,
oh, is she?
Yeah, so even though there's all these fucked up rights issues with Rob Liefeld stuff these days, technically Alan Moore owns this character, although I doubt he'd ever do anything with her. And on the second issue cover where she's on by Rob Liefeld, who gives her gigantic knockers
yes.
that are held together by one of those bra belts, you know, before they were in vogue.
And no feet.
Yeah. She's got a sash with a various Spawn icons, so you can see that she's had some successful Spawn hunting done as well.
And so she's walking up to finish off the Violator. She hits the Professor, the only one she doesn't kill when the Professor confronts her. Badrock is, I guess, in a sense, protecting the Violator. She's getting to the room. Violator's kind of getting inside his head, talking shit. She picks up the orb. What was that orb from?
You know, I'm not sure. I think it has something to do with the what they're trying to use to open up a portal to hell.
Okay.
I think it's something that the Institute was using to make that happen. Because they've got this platform where they're just going to use the energy that they're planning on drawing from the Violator to activate this platform, this orb that's supposed to help them get access to hell.
At this point, Bedrock in his infinite intelligence decides by letting out the Violator to fight the Angel, they'll beat the shit out of each other and hopefully he'll be so weakened that he can take out whoever's left. And he decides to release the Violator.
Yeah, but instead the Violator becomes the clown, pretends to be human. Celestine, obviously not the brightest person either, falls for this and starts thinking that Badrock is the demon she's going after. They fight, and while she's preoccupied, Violator comes up behind her and rips out her heart through her boobs, her gigantic, ridiculous, almost entirely naked boobs, in a rather graphic fashion.
And he's playing air guitar as he's doing this.
Yeah, he's getting a lot, oh, and he thrusts his pelvic region and stuff. He says schwing. He takes a lot of Wayne and Garth-isms.
I thought this scene was kind of cool. So, what's her name? Celestra?
Celestine.
So Celestine is, in her dying moment, reaches over and grabs the orb where the orb was and basically pumps it full of angel energy and teleports the entire building to hell. So Alan Moore revisits the 8 levels of hell. Was it 8 levels he created?
I think so, yeah. So it was in issue 8 of Spawn, and we're seeing a lot of the same creatures that were introduced in that story that he did.
And again, it is called the Dante Project, so you know, Dante's Inferno. Here we go. We're teleported back, and of course the first thing the doctor wants to do is get out there and start studying shit.
Which I thought was kind of crazy. Very gung-ho.
Yes.
I've really enjoyed Brian Denham's artwork in the series. He definitely has a super cut Badrock. He's not the pudgier Badrock we usually see with Rob Liefeld. This dude is just fucking ripped. And while he definitely has stylistic similarities to Rob Liefeld, he's also clearly been looking at Stephen Platt during his peak days. And he does really fucking stuff, right? Fine. And so he's doing a lot of fine detailing and cross-hatching, and it looks really fucking cool. It's one of these things where, like, some of his other characters are much more basic, like the women don't have a lot of detail to them. And you can see where he's not nearly on the same plane as some of the other image artists. But when he really focuses on an image, and especially he gets to cut loose on Badrock since he doesn't have to be photorealistic and he just put in all the ridiculous detailing he wants to, he's great at drawing Badrock. I would have to say he's my favorite Badrock artist pretty easily. The rest of the stuff doesn't look quite as good. He's good with the hell stuff, I think, and okay with Violator.
I do like, you know, even the creatures in hell, he does pretty cool.
Well, it's really cool to see all the ones from the Spawn number 8.
Yes.
I remember how much you liked all of them.
The blood spiders, and you have some kind of giant snake octopus thing that's shooting out of the portal. They show the giant angel, which I thought was cool as shit.
The robot angel with the flaming hair and the rockets.
Yeah.
And there's a page there, too, where he manages to knock her away, and he's looking out at her, and man, very Will Portasio. You could definitely see that he was taking a lot of influence from the other image artists, and some of the ones I tend to like better. So I really dig that.
At this point, the clown turns back into Violator since he's in hell. The brothers are there again. They see the portal. The angel is knocked out, the steampunk angel. The brothers, they realize that the person they took wasn't the clown, right?
I don't know. Probably by that point. They're not that stupid.
And so they see this building, decide they're going to go and investigate it themselves. The last panel is basically all the brothers showing up with the Violator and Badrock and the... Oh, no, that's not the last panel, but it's a lead-up, basically a family reunion amongst the brothers.
Yeah, and also it's worth noting that the Celestine body, this, you know, it's a corpse, but its power is still surging through the device, but she is slowly aging to dust. And so they basically have a sense of the timetable they're working off of, how long they have before they're going to return to Earth. Earth. And so the Doctor is insisting on going out and exploring hell, trying to pick up fauna and shit like that. And meanwhile, she gets caught between Violator and the Fleabag brothers.
And of course, Bedrock just wants to get back to Earth. He's adamant about protecting her, but she doesn't really want his protection.
And he's got a huge crush on her too. It's obvious.
Yeah. It's awkward, shooing, crush. The Bedrock ends up fighting the Violator's brothers.
Yeah, he shoves one of the brothers into the other brother's gullet. And so they're walking around like a dual-assed creature for a little bit.
Yes, Bedrock's bogus journey.
Bill and Ted were another influence on the characterization of the people in this miniseries.
How did you think the artwork's holding up so far?
Like I said, I think that Bedrock looks really fucking cool. As cool as he ever looks is when he's drawn by Brian Denham. I think he just has a way of doing the head and the eyebrows that's more effective than anybody else ever could. But a lot of the other figures around him aren't so great. I think he's good at drawing hell. He's pretty good at drawing the Fleabag brothers. But when it comes to the human characters, he just doesn't seem to have a level of interest or the command to make it look nearly as good as the other figures, or maybe just lack of interest. He's putting so much effort into the areas that you can tell he's into that I think maybe other areas get short shrift. But you do have some decent backgrounds. Not great. Definitely image good, not objective good. but there are backgrounds, and I got to give him some credit for that.
This was the Bedrock toy I remember seeing in the stores.
Absolutely.
When he puts on the armor.
So at one point, before everything goes to hell, but on bump, there's a delivery crew that's bringing Bedrock this great big box. And apparently this is when they ship him his dumb bunny rabbit apple seed armor, which he's fucking Bedrock. Why does he need guns and armor? But
yeah. We've
seen him do that, have that action
with the mini pockets,
with all the pockets and the shoulder pads and everything else. Yes. But the main thing is, you know, Rob Liefeld getting way, way into robot bunny years, as you pointed out in previous episodes.
Yes. And so he decides he's going to go out and find the professor who had taken off to go explore hell in his armor. And the Violator's watching him walk off, and the Violator just wants to leave as well, doesn't he?
Yeah, he wants to get the hell out of there.
Yeah, he doesn't want to stay in hell. I don't believe he's welcome there anymore. He's kind of fucked up too much. He's kind of ruined his name.
He's on the outs with Malbolgia, and he knows if Malbolgia catches him, he's going to get fucked with again. The Fleabag brothers are wanting him, and frankly, I think he likes being a powerful bully on Earth.
True. We have that scene where he opens up, I guess, that rocket launcher on his shoulder and blows up some demons when he's trying to protect the Doctor. He starts punching things. There's some new monster I don't remember seeing before. They find the orb, or he has the orb. He's surprised that the Doctor's not grateful for being rescued. She seems a little one-dimensional.
She's very driven. She's definitely the hard-ass, cold, career-driven person, but I do like that she's clearly an intellectual. She definitely has curiosity that she's not, and she's fairly fearless. I mean, she's not stupid enough to not realize that she's in great danger. This is a perilous course of action, but she's so driven to explore that she can't help herself.
Okay.
But she's also really unpleasant and really mean to Bedrock, so that's definitely comes off as one-dimensional as well.
Well, true. They come across the brothers again. Violator and Bedrock are, I guess by now the time is ticking, right? In terms of what's left of the angel.
Exactly. Yeah, because if they don't get out before the angel juice is tapped, they're going to remain in hell.
And now this was the part I thought was weird. Apparently Bedrock can use the angel's baton or her staff.
Yeah. That was a little different. But he uses it to blast the Violator. At the very end,
yes. They
trap Violator in hell.
And when they teleport back, of course, his brothers are there waiting for him. And I guess, was there supposed to be another series after this, or?
I don't know. Again, you know, the market got weird. It seemed like the door was left open. There also is a note that Admonisher got out of hell off panel. He gets referenced, which is cute. So he's still out there somewhere. They will call back. Let's see. We don't know who this guy is. He ain't like a demon or anything, but he's covered in muscles with guns everywhere. He keeps asking for somebody called Roosevelt, so says he's going to admonish him. So they do the Roosevelt call back to the first miniseries.
That's cute. So, and that's pretty much it.
Yeah.
Like I said, this was my least favorite one. This one was a little bit of a chore to get through.
No, I enjoyed it. It wasn't.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, I enjoyed both miniseries. Obviously, the art by Bart Sears is incomparable, but I just really enjoyed what Denham was doing with Bedrock. I've never enjoyed looking at Bedrock in action as much as when Denham was drawing him. It is a shame that he's not so great with the human characters, especially the women. The anatomy's a little wonky with women. He gets way better drawing women later on. Yeah, I actually have a piece that he did of a female character that's fucking excellent. But he's also done an Iron Man miniseries that was written by Adam Warren with a female villain, and she sort of like recalls Joe Linsner's Dawn. And man, he draws some fucking fantastic, cool goth chicks. But unfortunately, that's really not in evidence in this miniseries. So that is a bit of a weak point. Some of the action is kind of so-so, but overall, I really enjoyed it. I think it was much better than anybody had a right to expect from a miniseries called Violator versus Bedrock out of Extreme Studios.
Okay.
Well, in the 90s, you know, I was at Extreme Studios maybe a year and a half or so. I left Extreme Studios and I went to I went back home to Dallas. And that was right before like Extreme Studios started collapsing, all the mid 90s Image collapsed, you know, Extreme got turned into Awesome and Maximum or something else. There's another name for a while, Arcade. It felt like my time to go. And some of the other artists there, they'd left for animation right at the beginning of an animation thing. So I left, I went home, and there was some convention at a small town south of Fort Worth called Cleburne. And I went there, and there was Antarctic Press guys, and there was Chaos Comics. And I got to meet Brian Polito, and I got to meet a bunch of the Antarctic Press guys. And so after I left the Extreme Studios and I moved there, I remembered that some of the one of the other coworkers at this comic book store I worked at, he was really big into this Antarctic Press book called Twilight X. Anyway, the creator of that was there, and I just started freaking out over his book because it was such an awesome book. And but both Antarctic Press and Chaos were like, oh, we'd love for you to do some stuff for us, you know. Brian Polito said, draw a couple of pinups by Monday and they better knock my socks off, and if they do, I'll give you work. If they don't, we'll just go our separate ways, you know. I was like, okay. So I did some stuff for Brian Polito, sent it to him on Monday. Antarctic Press called and they said, come down here, we just want to, you know, hang out and let you look at our studio. And I did that. So I got some work from Chaos. Antarctic Press, you know, I just drove down there just for a little day trip or whatever, and you know, checked out the studio. That was when, man, that studio was packed at that time, you know. There was a lot of guys there, and they even had cleaning service, they had insurance, you know. They were popping, you know, because they were doing really good with Warrior Nun and all that stuff. But they had asked if, after I left, if I wanted to draw Warrior Nun, because they wanted a new look on Warrior Nun separate from Ben's manga style, Ben Dunn, the creator of Warrior Nun. That's how I got started at Antarctic Press. And since then, I've left and gone to work at Top Cow and other companies, DC, Marvel, and all that stuff. But I always do stuff for Antarctic anytime they'd ever call. But they told me from like 1997, you know, if you ever want to do anything the rest of your life, we will publish it. Like, you don't even have to pitch anything to us. Which was a relief, knowing that there's that outlet there, you know. So about 10 years ago, I moved down here and just started becoming more a part of the studio, you know. And just a couple years ago, I became editor-in-chief. And now I do the Diamond Heads, you know. I have to do Diamond Heads by Wednesday, you know. Takes a couple of days to do them, you know. But I do logos for them, all these different books. Sometimes I do covers.
So you really did enjoy these then, huh?
Again, we've had to get through some slog. We've slogged through some shit, let's be honest.
Yeah.
So is it The Dark Knight Returns or anything? No. But relative to the stuff we've read from Image, I think it's great. And I also just enjoy Alan Moore cutting loose. And in fact, this is probably something we ought to talk about a little bit right quick while I'm thinking about it. So There's an interview in Hero Illustrated number 23, cover dated May 1995. And it was actually dual interviews, The Punk and The Godfather. And basically, you had the guy who did Lethargic Man interview Rob Liefeld at the same time somebody else, I can't recall who it was interviewing Alan Moore. And so what was weird is they bisected each page, and part of it would be Alan Moore and part of it would be Rob Liefeld, so you can almost like compare and contrast. But I tried reading them like back and forth and it just doesn't fucking work. You finally just had to stop and read one interview and then read the other interview. It's Greg Hyland who's interviewing Liefeld. Moore's interviewed by Impy Love Stories' Steve Darnell. Moore liked revisiting concepts of hell from his Spawn issue and laughed a lot while writing the stories. He was basically getting his kicks writing this goofy shit. He needed a break from the heavy stuff, because this was back when he was doing Lost Girls and From Hell. He needed the heavy stuff to make up for how goofy the Image stuff was, but he also needed the lightness of the Image stuff to get through how hard some of the work he was doing in that time period was on his more personal work. He also said he enjoyed writing for a younger audience, but he did find that plotting out the layouts for the Image stories, because again, he would literally draw each page of his comics just to give the artist a sense of what he was going for. And and trying to lay out all the shit that he was asking the artist to draw was difficult for him. It was more physically demanding to do that than, you know, obviously from Talking Heads and From Hell. So meanwhile, Rob Liefeld said that he did tributes, not swipes, and that he never used action figures for reference, because apparently they were accusing him of using action figures to pose for his drawings. Hyland specifically said that he recognized an action figure from a Liefeld drawing, but he denied it. Hyland said that it was unethical for Rob Liefeld to draw the way he does, because his anatomy promoted ignorance of the anatomical form, too much exaggeration with a weak perspective. I think that Liefeld called McFarlane's Spider-Man anatomy lazy as in reply, and he admitted that he's never going to do Akira backgrounds or Jim Lee-like realism. Liefeld, he loves artists like Jeff Smith, but that's not who he is either. He doesn't see inherent merit in the excessive panels of George Perez. Like, when he came back to Youngblood after all the criticism he took, he tried to do all these little tiny panels and all these, like, headshots and everything else. He was trying to force himself to do more panels per page and Talking Heads so that the readers would get more value out of his comic books, because he was tired of people saying that you could read his comic books too quickly.
Mm-hmm.
At the same time, he was looking at what Mark Silvestri was doing in Cyberforce, and how Silvestri was actually getting away from doing Talking Head type of stuff that he used to do with Chris Claremont, and he realized, look, I'm Rob Liefeld. He doesn't want to feel like he was neutered drawing like Kurt Swan, you know, or that's how he was feeling. He wanted to draw kick-ass, throw everybody around fight sequences. That was his strength in life. I actually recently retweeted a video that a British fellow did where they tried to say that Rob Liefeld was the Kurt Cobain of comics, that he like had this punk aesthetic and that he kind of revolutionized the form and shit. And I really don't think that's true. I think that
not even close. Yeah,
maybe the Bush of comics.
No, he's more along the lines of not the sharpest tool in the shed. Smash Mouth. Yes, he's the Smash Mouth. Maybe
the lyrics of Walking in the Sun are actually quite good, I have to say. Read the lyrics one of these days. My father once, like, he really liked Smash Mouth, and he bought like three of their albums, and he made a point of sitting there and breaking down the lyrics for me of Walking on the Sun, and he compared it to The Beat Goes On by Sonny and Cher, and basically talking about sociopolitical elements in the work of Smash Mouth. So don't sleep on Smash Mouth.
All right. I did not know you were such an defender of them.
I'm not here to defend Smash Mouth, but old dude will if you get him riled up.
All right, fine. They're the fucking better than Ezra. He's the better of Ezra.
I like better than Ezra, though.
Oh my god. But of course you would. Of course you would.
King of New Orleans.
I'm trying to stay away from Veruca Salt and all the other bands you love. So.
You know how I feel about Rob Liefeld's artwork? It's good. Whoa, whoa, whoa. No?
Oh, that's horrible.
No, look, I'm fond of Rob Liefeld. Kurt Cobain is too much, but I do think he gets shit on way too much. And I do think, well, again, he talks a little bit about this. He called Youngblood number one a mess with uncompleted additional pages that were rushed out and didn't make sense. He talked about how he'd been negotiating with Fox for 6 months after walking away from CBS. And of course, the Youngblood cartoon never came out, regardless of all of his efforts. The problem with being at CBS is he had visions of his cartoon coming out like Fish Police or The Flash or Kellogg's and Dinosaurs, and he didn't want a sucky cartoon, and he thought that the Wildcats cartoon that came out of CBS actually damaged the Wildcats brand. Finally, he talked about how he was starting Maximum Press for more non-Image style books like Evangeline, Black Flag, and Battlestar Galactica. I'm not sure how not Image that was. I think actually maybe he was a little bit forward looking about what Image would become fairly quickly, so I think it's a shame that he didn't just keep the books at Image, which the Image partners agreed on. I think that Rob Liefeld works best when he's not realistic, and that British guy who was called comparing him to Cobain, I don't buy that, but he did compare him a lot to Jack Kirby, and I do think there's a lot to be said for that, because Jack Kirby also did not have proper anatomy, but he had dynamism that was not present in comic books before he basically invented it for the medium. And I know Kirby isn't for everybody either, but there is so much in common between Liefeld and Kirby. Kirby was a better storyteller, no question about it, but I think there's a dynamism to Liefeld and an action, and he's much better when he's not trying to be anatomically correct, and just by virtue of being anatomically correct doesn't make you a better artist.
True.
Now we're moving on to Celestine, number one, which was released...
What?
Huh?
Okay.
You lose me?
No, go ahead.
Okay, so now we're moving on to Celestine number 1, which was released on May 8th, 1996. So at this point, we're talking about almost 2 years out from Violator versus Bad Rock. The book was by Warren Ellis, Patrick Lee, and a whole lot of inkers that I'm not going to go into. Number 1 was ranked 29th for the month that it was released. So obviously, it did much better than Violator versus Bad Rock, it seems like. Maybe. I don't know. Because I think I was basing on years and one I'm basing my months. So that might be the most accurate parallel. Number 2 ranked number 49th when it was released 2 months later. It was only a 2-issue miniseries. And on the Turok-ometer, we're now along the lines of Turok Dinosaur Hunter number 47. That was the issue in which the book was canceled. So we've gone from Bart Sears launching Turok to Turok is now canceled.
Okay.
Celestine came out around the same time as Spawn number 45. So as you recall, we're starting in the 20s, and then we're in the 30s for Violator Bad Rock, and now we're in the 40s, almost the 50 with Spawn. So you want to tell a little bit about the plot of Celestine while I go grab a drink?
Well, hold on, dude. It's been a long time since I've read this book.
Okay, I gotta go grab a drink and you flip through it right quick.
Okay.
Because as you can hear, my voice is getting pretty raw.
I mean, it's her waking up in hell. I remember that vaguely.
Right, right. And so there's this female devil. There's an unfamiliar version of hell because Celestine's been to hell before and she recognizes this isn't hell, even though it's being communicated to her that it is hell. And so she's like, no, this is bullshit. I'm dead. This isn't hell. What the fuck's going on? She's very suspicious. Meanwhile, there's a researcher named Joseph Yalop who is with the Whiteside Parsons Institute. So this is one instance where that does get revisited. And he is trying to seek hell or this female devil. I don't really recall the specifics of it. Meanwhile, Nama, the demoness, is working in a position to him. She gets enlisted by some angels that don't seem to be the angels from Spawn comics because they don't have the kiss makeup. Or maybe they're just like lower ranking. I'm not sure which. They're similar enough, though, that I assume there was like some parody.
I always assumed Angela and them were like archangels. And these are another type of angel.
The more basic bitches.
Yeah, administrative angels type.
Well, I mean, you take somebody like, was it Gabriella that was the one who worked on Earth and we never saw her with the eye makeup, for instance.
That's true. So, okay, so she's being walked through hell, which is, I mean, the artwork's okay.
Yeah. What do you think about Pat Lee? Did you ever see his stuff anywhere else?
No, not really.
Wasn't he the one who did those Dreamwave Transformers comics?
I don't know, man.
Did you pick up the Dreamwave stuff?
No. I think I picked up like 1 or 2 issues and it just wasn't for me.
Pat Lee's style evolved a lot over the years. I think that he's definitely taking cues from Michael Turner here. He's definitely trying to do that brittle, he's got the lanky female figures and he's got like hyper detailing in parts and then more simple in other areas. I always felt like Turner had this sort of like brittle quality, like something flaky, like wood bark. I don't know. It always felt like things were shedding around him. It's just like the texture he had. That kind of a wood barky kind of thing going on, right? And so we've got these angels. They look a little bit more like Greco-Roman. You know, they're running around in togas with the little ornamentation around the edges and stuff. Celestine is still undressed.
I'm about to say, she's not really dressed.
Like, she's constantly, they're finding ways to hide her nipples while she's essentially nude, even though she's supposed to be in costume. But over the course of fighting the demon, she keeps, like, getting stripped, and, like, parts of her seem to get covered. She's running around in a thong. And then you got the demon chick she's fighting, who's got porcelain skin, Loki horns, but they're more like a bull. And then she can turn, she's got, like, the witch blade, but it's not a witch blade. And
she has, like, kind of, like, raven claws on her feet.
Yeah.
And in one hand.
Got some Indian stuff in the mix, it seems like, in her outfit. I don't know. But anyway,
it's still a cool design.
Yeah. The devil chick keeps fucking with Celestine, either mentally or just physically beating the shit out of her throughout the first issue.
But what's the point of it? See, you tore Sodom and Gomorrah open, murdered children in the Passover. You're a fanatic. Oh, okay. So she's kind of punishing her. So I guess she's in what, angel hell?
They're not clear at this point.
Okay.
Hadn't Warren Ellis already worked on Witchblade at this point by 96? Because they did that Witchblade anthology series, right? The Tales of the Witchblade or something like that?
Yes. I read, where she's in Egypt.
Yeah, you can definitely see the influence there.
God's instrument of destruction, the angel Celestine, was sent to Earth on a mission to annihilate the demon scourge known as the Violator. Tricked into believing that Bedrock was her quarry, Celestine was momentarily distracted and attacked from behind by the Violator, who succeeded in ripping out her heart. And with her death, she fell into the depths of hell to find out where angels go when they die.
And so Nama the demoness is continuing to work with the angels. She manages to get to like the gates of heaven where there's demon heads on pikes and shit like that. I guess she was going through heaven to get to where the little sorcerer guy from the institute, he's kind of a diminutive figure, he's kind of a small person, Joseph Yalop. And so she manages to get to where he's casting his spell to open up the gate to hell. I think he's trying to release Celestine from this false version of hell. And so Nama manages to finally find a way around his circle of protection and uses her xenomorph demon tongue thing to split
to kill the angels.
In half,
yeah,
very bloodily. And so he's killed.
Wears her head as an. She wears the angel's head as a hat
at one point. Yeah, and so this guy is basically creating an opportunity for Celestine to get out of this false hell. She almost makes it to the gates of the exit, and then because of his death, she ends up trapped in that hell, and that's where her story ends. Now, do you have any idea why we just spent 2 issues with the postmortem of Celestine?
No.
So this is actually a setup for a crossover between Celestine and Angela, and between Extreme and McFarlane, although it's all done by Extreme. We're not going to touch on that for a long time. Until Angela's adventures catches back up with Spawn, we're not going to address her. But I did want to make sure that we pointed out while we were dealing with Celestine in the Violator vs. Bad Rock miniseries that even though the character is dead, that's not the end for her. I mean, she's an angel and there's more to death than just dying.
So was this a way for them to get away from Alan Moore's version of Celestine by morphing her and changing her up?
Well, I think that if the character is called Celestine and it's a direct continuation of the previous miniseries, I don't think you can get around that. And in fact, the copyright notice for Alan Moore is in the issues alongside with the copyright notice for Violator being Todd McFarlane's. Oh, okay. I don't think it's that. I think it's just reintroducing the character after she had been gone for a while. And since Alan Moore apparently didn't have any interest in doing this crossover miniseries, Warren Ellis helped to set it up. What did you think of the two-parter?
I'd have to read it, but I mean, it seems interesting. I mean, it seems just, like you said, it's just a setup for, I guess, the crossover when we get to it. She has a cool design. I did, as I was flipping through, you were right, they did find a lot of ways to cover the nip.
Yeah, but they made no such effort with the ass. Her ass is all over this thing.
It's definitely a maximum cover come to life, kind of flopping around. And
Cisco is definitely the soundtrack of this version of Hell.
Okay. Thong, 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 thong.
Right?
Yes, I get your joke. Well played. Well played, sir. Well played.
I try.
So they did do the miniseries after all?
Yeah, that did come out. I'm assuming that it came out to completion, but again, I haven't read that. That's too far in the future. But I just wanted to show that there's more to Celestine than what we've seen so far, that they didn't just give up on her after she was killed. I think Alan Moore did. I don't think Alan Moore had much interest in doing anything else with her, but I guess he didn't care if anybody else did. And I guess you're going to get Warren Ellis some work.
Oh, yeah, because apparently they did do a Celestine and Glory crossover.
Yes, they did a Glory one and they did an Angela one.
Oh, okay.
So she's got more going on, but we haven't gotten there yet. We won't for a while. Cool. For me, this was definitely the weakest of the three miniseries we covered. There's not a lot to Celestine as a character, and without seeing where it's going, it just seems like a lot of spinning wheels. She's just hanging out in hell getting tortured, and there's a bunch of other shit going on around her, but I don't have any real context for it. And within the context of the miniseries, there's just not much that thrill me. I think it was a paycheck gig for Warren Ellis, and it shows, but it's not terrible. It's fine.
It's serviceable.
I'm not a big Pat Lee guy, but I did enjoy some of what he was doing in these stories. It was good for what it was.
So on Facebook, we got appreciation from DeBash and Derek William Crabb. On Twitter, it was 20th Century Geek Podcast, Adriano, Alex Chung, Baby Skeletor, CH, Chris Dunford, Chris Leiden, Comics 42, Doc Strange, Dr. Pop Culture BGSU, Ed Moore, Edward Hui, Fanholes Podcast, Green Lantern HG, The Hammer Strikes, Random Geeky Stuff, History of Comics on Film, Hulkling Hashtag Black Lives Matter, Iowa's Joe Crawford, Jason Roga, Jason Snicked Venable, Jeffrey Brown of Earth 1610, Joctastico, Capucha Antonio, Keith G. Baker, King Size Comics, Giant Size Fun Podcast, Christados, Luke Giaconetti, Earth Destruction Directive, Marvel Universe Online, Michael Wagner, Micah Send Aliens to Me, Nuka Carl Quantum, Odell Abner Dracula, Schlockpuss Inc., Siskoid, Sue Kent Ant, Talk Nerdy to Me, Tim Price the Pod Crasher, Under the Influence, Warlock Worlds, and Wonder Woman Warrior for Peace Podcast. Michael Wagner wrote, would pay to have their old spine crew cover the bat insanity of Batman Odyssey. The reactions would be fire. And I the problem is, I know that I can never get you guys to read that shit. Maybe fix it. Did you like Batman? Did you ever read Batman Odyssey?
The fuck is that?
And that's that Batman book that Neil Adams did about 5 to 10 years ago.
I'd read it. I'll check it out.
Okay. You do that and get back with me. Mike Sent Aliens to Me said, I liked the little I have seen of Tribe a lot. And that's part of the problem, is hardly anybody got to read any Tribe since it had such a sporadic schedule from so many different publishers. So that's definitely...
I think I have like the first 3 issues.
You were good about collecting independent comics publishers, or better than maybe I gave you credit for at times, because I don't think a lot of people made it to
have that Tribe poster at my mom's house.
Yeah,
on the
What is on that poster anyway?
Woman with a huge ass bent over facing you, or some other woman in the background. I don't remember.
So you got your chief benefit out of it then.
Yeah.
Yeah. but yeah, I don't think many people made it to the third publisher. So that was the fact you made it to a third issue is commendable. So Jeffrey Brown wrote, I will definitely be giving this a listen while I play Ultimate Alliance. Now, this series of comics and characters have always been a curiosity to me. I really like Larry Stroman's art and character design for Tribe. Definitely could have been or could still be a kick-ass animated series if it would have come out in the 90s on MTV Liquid Television. In the run-up to actually finally releasing the episode, I'm trying to burn off as many episodes as possible that we still have recorded from before the COVID times to take advantage of our the collective nostalgia, especially with ones like that one where the recording was shit. And it's part of the reason why it's been mothballed for so long is because the recording quality was bad, but it's nice to hear people talking when they're all in the same room together. But before we released that, I went in and I did character bios for a bunch of the different characters from Tribe. And so I understand what the hell was going on a lot better now. But what kills me is the first issue or two has a real Howard Chaykin quality where you feel like they're going to build to something that's more involved. And then it kind of degenerates into a bunch of fights. So even the potential that you saw in those early issues isn't built upon. So the show makes more sense by the time you get to the later issues, but there's not as much to it. And I wish they'd had the time to draw it out more actually and to make it more complex before it came down to the punch, kick, pow kind of stuff. So finally, Reverend Odell Abner Dracula wrote, I had that Man-Bat power record set once upon a time. Hey, Fixit, did you have any power records?
I had a He-Man one. Mm-hmm. I had an Incredible Hulk one, a Star Wars one, maybe a Mickey Mouse one or a Disney one.
Hmm. Okay.
Those are the only ones I can remember. Because I remember we had our little record player and you put on the, what was it, a little, was it? A
45?
Yeah, like a little 45 and you, oh, it was Peter Pan. Matter of fact, I remember that. It was
Peter Pan. Pan record.
It was
sure.
A Disney one. It was a Peter Pan.
Yeah.
If I remember correctly, it was. You just follow along with the book as it talked to you.
Yeah, it was a 45, but didn't it run at like 33 and a third so that you got more playtime out of it or something?
Well, is that how they? I don't remember. I just remember we started playing with it, trying to like make scratching sounds with it.
Of course. So Odell continues, I followed Tribe based on the graphic innovations Stroman used on X Factor. Number one didn't seem to make much sense on its own. It took me forever to find number two, and I don't believe I've ever seen subsequent issues in all the years/decades since. Stroman's Mr. Sinister was a triumph. I maintain nobody has drawn a better version before or since, and he included an image of Mr. Sinister by Stroman that pretty much always comes to mind when I think about Mr. Sinister. I liked Mr. Sinister okay when he was in the Uncanny X-Men, but I don't think he became one of my favorite X-Men villains until he was in that X-Factor run, because I think Peter David and Stroman did such a good job of portraying the character. And I like the quality of androgyny specifically that Stroman gave him, but I really dug that character in that run. That was one of my favorite aspects of their run together. And that's the end of Spawnometer, so moving on.
Between the golden age of Atlantis and the rise of recorded history, there were ages undreamed of. Hither came heroes and villains possessing swords and magic, whose deeds became tales and legends. I have come to relate these sagas. Let me tell you of the days of high adventure. Days of High Adventure, a new podcast discussing a variety of comics that fall into the fantasy or sword and sorcery genre. Available on most podcast services and Anchor FM.
Rosebud. It's Citizen Kane Minute. Hosted by film fanatic Rob Kelly and a collection of special guests, Citizen Kane Minute will examine the greatest film of all time, 5 minutes at a time. Coming soon to the Fire and Water Podcast Network.
There was an idea.
To bring together a group of remarkable people.
To see if we could become something more.
So when they needed us, we could make the podcasts.
That they never could.
Time, you will know what it is like to cross over
to feel so desperately that the comic is right, yet to fail all the same. Dread it. Run from it. March 2021 still arrives.
Evacuate the network. Engage all defenses. And get this man a cold Mountain Dew.
Ooh, a cold Mountain Dew. I haven't tried one of those. Nah. Make it warm. Thank you.
Fun isn't something one considers when podcasting an event. But this does put a smile on my face.
The hell are you guys?
Do you know it's jail?
The Merry Marvel Marching Society. We don't know where we're going, but we're on the way.
A podcasting crossover mega event in the spirit of JL May. Coming in March 2021. Covering Marvel's fall crossover event, Acts of Vengeance.
A cabal of evil threatens the Avengers and the entire Marvel Universe.
Dr. Doom, the Red Skull, Kingpin, Dr. Doom, Magneto, the Wizard, Dr. Doom, the Mandarin, and Dr. Doom have banded together to pit Earth's mightiest heroes against foes they have never faced before.
An array of heroes face enemies they are totally unfamiliar with.
But who is secretly pulling the vengeful cabal strings?
And can the Avengers take down the true mastermind before his hidden scheme succeeds?
Featuring podcasts from Third Degree Burn, Back to the Bins, Avenger Spotlight, Coffee and Comics, Comic Book Time Machine, Doom Speak, Fan Holes Podcast, Fire and Water Podcast Network, Head Speaks, Into the Weird, Justice, Not Entirely Dissimilar to Lightning, a Thunderbolts podcast, Longbox Crusade, Married with Comics, The Quantum Cast, Resurrections, an Adam Warlock podcast, Rolled Spine Podcasts, and Views from the Longbox.
Marching its way to your favorite podcatchers and hosting sites in 2021.
Act of Vengeance, a true story.
This is a fan-produced, not-for-profit podcast. No copyright infringement is intended, and any use of copyrighted materials believed to be covered under fair use. If you don't agree, you can go straight to hell!